It's been said that you should not discuss religion and politics in social situations. Maybe we should add education to that list. We sure get into lots of fights in this country about the proper way to teach children the things they need to know. Our guest this hour has probably been in quite a few of those fights. Paul Cummins ran a private school in the Los Angeles area for many years. That's the bulk of the story he tells in his book, Confessions of a Headmaster. Paul is president and CEO of the Coalition for Engaged Education, which is dedicated to offering engaged education to all young people. He's the author of 4 books on education, not including this one. Paul Cummins, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you were not a dedicated student yourself in high school, from what you say in the book. What finally interested you in being an educator yourself?
Oh, I think probably what happens to a lot of us. We meet an exciting teacher or two, and things turn around. In my case, my first teacher in college was a fellow student who decided I was pretty ignorant and he needed to do something about it for me. And then a Western civilization history teacher took great delight in pointing out to me almost every day in class how completely uninformed I was. And both of them I regarded as a challenge, so I decided I would show them that I wasn't stupid, which was pretty hard to do at the time because I sort of was, but they fired me up to want to learn, and then once I got involved in learning, then I fell in love with it.
So how did you get into Stanford if you were, as you put it yourself, kind of stupid?
Well, in those days, Stanford was not nearly as difficult to get into it as it is today. My SAT scores were abysmal, and my GPA was mediocre. I had been a good high school athlete. I was class president and captain of the basketball team and most valuable player on the football team. So I had a bunch of activities that made me look maybe more interesting than I probably was. And I also suspect, but I've never found out, but I also suspect that my father, who at the time was financially coming into his own, may have pulled a string or two.
So what plan did you have for a career when you went off to Stanford? It wasn't education.
I adored my father, and my father's plan for me was that I was to go off to Stanford, be an All-American football player, go to law school, and then come back and run the family business. And there were a few flaws in my father's plan for me. Number one, I wasn't good enough to make it on the freshman football team, much less varsity. I got injured, fortunately, so I could leave with dignity. And then my father's business went under, so there was no business to come home to. But in the meantime, I had fallen in love with history and literature and kind of the idea of teaching. I found myself thinking in college when I was excited about learning now, why am I excited now and I wasn't in high school? And I found myself daydreaming about the high school that I wished I had gone to. And it all came to head one day. I was sitting in a history lecture, and I kind of zoned out. And at the end of the period, I looked at what I had been doodling and writing furiously the whole period. And I had been outlining the school that I wished I had gone to. And it was one of those aha moments where you sort of know what you think you should do with your life.
And is that essentially what you created with the private school you worked at?
Well,
later?
Probably some of the ideas were kind of sophomoric and silly, but I did write my dad a letter that very night and told him I wanted to go into education and told him some of the dreams I had, and some of those have stayed the same. So
what would you say then, Paul, are some of the pillars of your approach to education?
I think the pillars, one sort of a key word is balance. And another key word is joy, and so I'll try and briefly deal with those. I think kids ought to wake up in the morning looking forward to going to school. And that isn't too hard to do if you provide an exciting environment for them. And what would that environment be? Well, I use the word balance. We talk so much about the importance of testing, and maybe you and I will get into that a little bit later.
Oh, yeah.
But in any event, what we test are kids' abilities in language skills and in mathematics. Those are the two main things that we test. And the main part of the curriculum is English, history, math, science, and foreign language. And in my book, and in another book I'm working on, and things I've written in the past, I argue that there's 5 other solids. And the 5 other solids are things that typically engage kids more than the 5 solids. So what are the 5 others? human development, giving kids a place where they can actually talk about their life's issues and have an occasional retreat to focus on what they're doing with their life and so on. So human development classes, community service, community action. Kids, adolescence is often a time of profound sort of narcissism and confusion, and kids really like to help others. It helps them find themselves. So a lot of schools have really wonderful community service programs. Third one, the arts. And by that I mean a rich array of arts offerings, music, dance, theater, visual arts, and so on. So that's a third one. Physical education, not just a football team and some cheerleaders, but hiking and backpacking and getting out into the outdoors. And then the fifth one, then environmental education, which we can come back to.
All right. Yeah, you hear the music. Thanks for responding.
I hear the music, so there's a pause, huh?
All right, so we got all five in, and we'll come back and talk more with these. Paul Cummins is the author of the book Confessions of a Headmaster. More on his views on education and how successful they were at the school he led for the better part of three decades when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Don't forget our one-day fun drive, 888-552-6191, ijpr.org. To equip a new JPR. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the longtime educator Paul F. Cummins. He ran a very successful private school in the Los Angeles area for many years. He's written up about that and about the formation of his ideas about education in his book, Confessions of a Headmaster. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the five additional solids that you just listed, in addition to the things that everybody identifies as the five solids, you got human development, community service, arts, physical education, and environmental education as well. It seems like a lot of the argument that we get recently in education, aside from testing, which we will talk about, is that kids are wandering away from the basics. And here you're talking about there are just more basics.
Well, there are more basics, but if kids are dropping out of school, it's pretty hard to educate them in anything. So a child who dropped, or a young man who, or woman who drops out of school, is by definition disengaged. So I think we need to look at, well, what is it that engages kids? And yes, academics and with exciting teachers do engage them, and they do need to have all those skills. I'm not denying that at all. I got my PhD, so I believe in academic education. But I also look at kids who are dropping out of schools because we've cut out of the budget so many of the programs that, in fact, engage them. The five others that you just listed and that I mentioned earlier have in common, they're all experiential, they're hands-on, they're project-based. And at my former school, Crossroads, when I go to 10, 20, 30-year reunions of kids, those are the things invariably they want to talk about.
Really, those are the ones that really kept their attention.
Those are the ones that got them excited about learning. And so I sort of believe when you get excited in one arena, that excitement often spills over into the others, in independent schools and in well-to-do schools. And in schools that aren't so well-to-do, it's even more important because you've got to get them to want to come to school in the first place. And to sit in an English class with 50 other students, where the teacher at best is just trying to keep order, is not terribly engaging.
So the Crossroads School, which is what a lot of the book is about, mm-hmm. you begin telling us in 1970 about being hired as headmaster, and it wasn't called Crossroads at that point. What were your qualifications to be a headmaster at that point in time?
my qualifications were pretty minimal at the time. I had been a department chair at one school. And I'd been an assistant head for 2 years at another school. So I guess that the typical pattern is to go from teacher to administrator to assistant head to maybe head. But I'd had virtually no experience in an elementary school. So the school that hired me to be the head of this elementary school, they were kind of desperate. And on paper, I looked pretty good to them. I had a PhD, and I had gone to Stanford and Harvard and so on. And so they took a chance on me, and some of them were delighted with the changes I brought, and others were not delighted at all.
Well, and you made changes pretty quickly. I noticed that you pretty much sacked all but, what, three teachers of the original set?
I know. I hadn't read the books on how you should come into a new place. You know, your typical book on administration is come into a new place, reconnoiter, spend a little year, make gradual changes, get to know your team. And my board chair said, look, there's 17 teachers here. Three of them are untouchable. Take a look at the other 14, and if you want to make some changes, go ahead. I did. I looked at the other 14, and then I let them all go and brought in my own team, which was on paper really idiotic. But it was kind of a dumb wisdom to it because I had my own team right away to work with. And at the end of the first year, the other three left. One moved, one changed careers, and one retired. And so I was able to really have 100% turnover in 2 years of faculty and bring in the people I wanted to bring in the program I wanted, which is some of the stuff we've been talking about. The school was kind of rigid and old-fashioned, and I brought in balance to it. I brought in the arts and excitement for kids.
So this was an Episcopal school. What kind of reaction did you get from parents, from higher-ups in the Episcopal Church, and so on?
There were some problems there, but I was kind of saved because at the beginning of my second year, a new head came in. I mean, a new minister at the church, and he was a very progressive thinker, and he liked me, and we got along well, and so he backed me, even though I was getting a lot of criticism. And this was an Episcopal school, but the enrollment was going down. So I started admitting any families that wanted to come just for the education, and we wound up with families that were atheist and Jewish and all sorts of racial mixture, which the school hadn't had before. So there was a couple years of turmoil, but fortunately, I had this new rector who believed that I was doing God's work, and so he backed me.
You know, it's an interesting moment in the book when you talk about trying to design a service that you could have at this school that would appeal to people of all faiths or not faiths, and I guess you got it down to candles and songs.
We did, and Father Fenton, this man that I just mentioned, discovered that a menorah, the big candle, was a symbol in both Christian and Jewish history, and so we put that in and the lighting of that. And then we had kids, each different grade would do a little theme in between the lighting of the candles and the singing of the songs. And it was really quite wonderful, and a lot of parents started coming just because they liked being there.
Paul Cummins is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, president and CEO of the Coalition for Engaged Education. Engaged Education is what he called what he did at the Crossroads School in Santa Monica. His book is called Confessions of a Headmaster. So talk about structure and discipline in a school where you're trying to get students engaged. I mean, what you mentioned it was a pretty rigid school when you got there. What did you institute?
Well, we put in learning stations, so you'd have three or four kids in one corner working on this and another three or four kids working in another corner working on that. We had learning stations where kids could progress at their own speed, so they would be reading in these different reading programs where you could read at your own level. I had really small classes because the school didn't have the arts. So I brought into this elementary school music, art, dance, and drama. So while half of the kids were with the music teacher or the drama teacher, the other half were in the classroom with a teacher and an aide. So there was much smaller student-teacher ratio, and you could give individual attention. Initially, the kids were kind of baffled by not having to sit in rows of desks all day long. Mm-hmm. And they got a little rambunctious it was kind of like when you put a lid on a hot boiling thing of water and take the lid off, then there's that sort of explosion. So initially the kids didn't know how to deal with any kind of self-discipline opportunities, but we had to teach them that, and gradually they learned.
It's clear from what you write in the book that you were focusing not just on what you were doing at what became Crossroads School, but also looking at what was going on in the rest of the world. And this is so the early 70s, California schools hadn't been hit by the Prop 13 budget cuts yet. But what did you observe in public schools at that time in general terms and in quality?
Well, initially, I wasn't paying much attention because I was getting so much grief from some of the parents and some board members who thought I was going too fast and too radical and so on. So it wasn't until a little bit later on I started kind of taking a closer look at what was happening in public education. I was pretty myopically focused on my own school at that time. There was a lot of dissatisfaction in the public schools, though, already, and there were parents who were marching on this and that, and so my school actually built their enrollment by appealing to a bunch of dissatisfied people in the local public schools. But a little bit later on, I started visiting public schools to see what was going on, and that sort of changed my life, because I found that most of these, not most, but many of the schools that I visited had no arts programs at all, and many others were completely segregated. And so that led me into two new ventures, which I don't know if you want me to talk about now.
Sure.
But I decided I could do something about each of those issues, not much, because, you know, one guy is not going to solve, you know, integration and segregation problems, but I thought I could start a school. It was focused on integration. So I started a new school called New Roads, and we set as our mission that 40% of the student population must be non-white. And that has persisted now for 20 years at that school. Then I looked at the arts, and I got lucky. I met a guy named Herb Alpert, you know, pretty wonderful musician who had just sold his record company and offered to help me put the arts back into public schools through grants from his foundation. And so we created something called PS Arts here in Los Angeles, and that organization puts arts programs back into public schools where they've been deleted.
That's quite an effort there. But it sounds like even within what became Crossroads School, it started out as St. Augustine, you had to convince some of the parents of the value of bringing as much arts education as you wanted to bring in.
Yeah, I did. I had to do that, and I also had to actually, if you can believe it, I had to have meetings with parents, sort of reassuring them that it was okay for their kids to come home from school really happy and looking forward to going to school the next day. That wasn't their experience with school, and they thought maybe it wasn't academic enough if the kids were enjoying it so much, which is kind of ironic, isn't it?
So they want to go to school. What's wrong with them?
That's right. So, but I think gradually, I found that part of my job was educating the kids, but I also found that part of my job was educating the parents and getting them to take a couple deep breaths and not be quite so anxious and worried about whether their kids were going to get, whether their five-year-old was going to get into Yale or not.
We're talking to Paul Cummins. He's a longtime educator in the Los Angeles area, and has written a book called Confessions of a Headmaster. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about his approaches to education involving engaging students. He's now the head of the Coalition for Engaged Education. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 on the phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So over time, you turned what had been St. Augustine into Crossroads. You ended up with one school on two campuses, essentially. Some scruffy beginnings, the Baptist Church. The LA Times described this as all the ambience of a tire factory. I mean, you had dreams of a leafy campus and all. What happened?
Well, you know, we were always a day late and a dollar short every time I looked at trying to find a new campus. And so we moved into one kind of warehouse, remodeled it. And then with the seventh and eighth, and when the eighth became ninth, we moved across an alley into another little warehouse, and then when the ninth became 10th and 10th became 11th, we purchased an apartment on a corner and kind of remodeled it into classrooms, and then an automobile body shop, and one by one the school started acquiring pieces of property out of necessity, because we couldn't find that 5 or 10 acre parcel, and even if we had, we couldn't afford it. So then we started seeing something kind of interesting, that the kids started kind of taking a reverse pride in going to it was a college prep school, but it had this kind of funky campus, and the campus was almost an equalizer. Kids who came from really rich, fancy homes and kids who came from poor neighborhoods came to this school that had an alley running down the middle of it, and there was this kind of reverse pride that set in. Well, I go to a school that has an alley running down the middle of it.
How were you able to get poor kids into this school? What did you do in terms of financial aid for students who would have otherwise been in public school?
We gave a lot of full scholarships to low-income kids. And when we founded the school, Crossroads, we set a principle that's kind of been in stone ever since, that 10% of the operating budget would go into financial aid. So that very first year of the school, the operating budget was $45,000, and we put $4,500 into financial aid. And now the school's operating budget, I think, is in excess of $45 million, and they're putting in over I think it's $6 or $7 million worth of financial aid.
How many years had you been at it before people began? What it sounds like they began beating down the doors after a while, wanting to get in.
Well, it took a while. I mean, initially we were perceived as, you know, kind of the hippie, artsy, super progressive, touchy feely school over there on the west side, and so a lot of people who were applying to the elitist private schools were applying to Crossroads as their backup in case they didn't get in these other schools. And they would kind of close their eyes and hold their nose and put their kid in if they had to. But then gradually we started moving up the ranks, and people started saying, well, the XYZ was their first choice, but Crossroads was their second. And then as kids started, this kind of word of mouth in the city started going around that this is a place that's academically challenging, but it's also has a certain amount of excitement, and kids love it, and there is a nice balance of the arts. And so gradually people started realizing this is a pretty good place, and it started becoming people's first choice. But it took 10-15 years for that to happen.
Okay, so a whole cohort of students came and went before you had a chance to
yeah, well, and then it has to, because it's you can advertise all you want, but the best advertising in any given school is word of mouth, and that you have to have the people who are going out mouthing it, and they have to have been there long enough to be excited about it. So it takes time.
All right. Let's take a call here. Here's Jenny in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Cummins. His book is Confessions of a Headmaster.
Hello, Paul. I love people like you.
Hi, Jenny. Well, I love people like you.
Oh, good. Well, you don't know what I'm going to say yet, but it's all good. I worked at a school. It was called in the 70s Free School.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't all, you know, like you said, oh, a kind of hippie, let them run amok and pee in the corner if they want. No, but we let them discover what they were good at. And one, a judge sent a kid there that was 14 and truant and a lot of trouble. And all he wanted to do was build model ships, you know, balsa wood and that dopamine paper.
Mm-hmm.
Dopamine. Oh, boy. Freudian slip there.
Well, a lot to be learned doing that.
He never wanted to learn math, but guess what? When you build ships, eventually, if you build them better and bigger, you have to learn some math
when you
cut and measure.
All right. Thanks for the story, Gene. Appreciate that. So, Paul, actually, some of this comes back to you. Didn't you build model airplanes yourself?
Well, I tried to. I wasn't very good at it, but the kid across the street built them, and I just admired his ability to do that. This was back in, you know, during World War II. I'm dating myself a little bit, but they had those wonderful model airplanes made out of, you know, paper and toothpicks and balsa wood, and it was great fun.
Hmm. So getting into ways of engaging kids. I mean, you talked about the fact that there were 17. Teachers when you first got to St. Augustine, and three were untouchable, and you fired the other 14. What is it you look for in teachers?
Well, you know, the one obvious thing is if you're, for example, at the high school level, if you're hiring a history teacher, then you look for somebody who knows something about history and who's passionate about it. So I would, in my interviews of teachers, I'd really press to see if there was at least a degree of scholarship involved in them, so that they really loved their subject matter. Then I always watch them teach, and I'm sort of amazed at people who hire teachers without ever watching them teach. And if I couldn't go to their school and watch them teach, then I would have them come to my school, and I'd set up a demonstration kind of class situation and watch them teach. And he would say, well, doesn't that put a lot of pressure on them? Yeah, it does. But the good ones rise to it. So I would watch them teach. Then watching them teach, I would look for, does the lesson have any sense to it? Is there any continuity to this lesson? What's the guy trying to accomplish? And then the fourth thing, very quickly, wherever you can find it, I would look for teachers who could create a little bit of magic.
All right. We're going to talk more with Paul Cummins about what he looks for in a teacher and what he expects from education and his book, Confessions of a Headmaster, and the rest of his work. We'll come back and talk more with Paul and take your phone calls and emails. Don't forget our fund drive, 888-552-6191, ijpr.org for a new JPR. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the longtime educator Paul F. Cummins, president and CEO of the Coalition for Engaged Education, which is about offering engaged education to all young people. He is the author of four books on education, but now a new one called Confessions of a Headmaster, his own memoir about turning what was St. Augustine, an Episcopal school in L.A., into the renowned Crossroads Private School. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. When we were talking about qualifications you look for in a teacher, have those modified at all over the years, Paul?
Not for me, no. I still look for the same four things, I'm still looking for the same stuff. I'm still looking for that teacher that can walk into a classroom and, because of his or her passion, excite kids. Passion is contagious, and knowledge is also a little bit contagious. We've had a history teacher at Crossroads for years and years who is a wonderful, has wonderful energy in the classroom, but he's just so intelligent and he knows so much about what he's teaching that it's exciting for kids.
Hmm. How did you approach discipline, particularly as Crossroads expanded into the high school years?
Well, obviously you're going to have kids occasionally who misbehave. But what I found is that as the program became more and more exciting to kids, there were fewer and fewer discipline problems. And then I mentioned to you earlier something called council, which we've been doing at Crossroads for a long, long time, mm-hmm. where kids sit in a circle. And they have a talking piece that goes around the circle, and the rules of council are that you can only speak when you're holding the talking piece. And we do that once a week at every grade level, and kids learn how to listen to each other. And when you start listening to your classmates and seeing that they have some of the same issues you do, it becomes unthinkable to bully them and to be mean to them and tease them. And then... because the teachers there are, for the most part, not just your teachers, but they're your friends. You don't go over to your friend's house and misbehave. Well, you don't misbehave in the classroom. So, I think in the last 20 years at Crossroads, there have been maybe two fist fights.
Wow,
and one of them was a girl. One of them were two girls going at it. So, I mean, it just doesn't happen when the environment is correct.
This sounds similar to the restorative justice program that some school districts, including in our area, are starting to use, where there's a relationship form.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've been involved, actually, for 13 years in trying to bring quality education electives into a boys' incarceration facility. And I find that when we give them a certain amount of encouragement and when we give them really quality programs, and when we show some interest in their lives and give them an opportunity to express themselves in a positive way, they turn around. Some of the transformations at this camp are just short of miraculous.
Hmm. Let's take some calls. We have Chris in Wairika on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Cummins.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that my hat's off to you. Thank you for providing such a great environment for so many kids. Which I was in one of your schools when I was in, going through the lower grade levels. The main thing I wanted to ask was, it sounds like you're a private school, is that right?
Yes, but I've also been involved now in the co-creation of three charter schools here in Los Angeles.
And, okay,
Okay. I'm working with a group of people to start a private school, but for really low-income kids in South Dakota, in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, on a Native American reservation. And I kind of am trying to work in both arenas, both the private and the public.
All right, Chris, was there more to your question?
Well, I was wondering first if Paul thought he could do what he did with his school as a charter school, number one, which mm-hmm. I think he's kind of answering the question.
Mm-hmm.
And then my second question would be that not all kids are kind of academically oriented. And my son goes to a kind of prep school. It's a charter school, and he's doing great there. But I find that some of the kids that aren't oriented in that direction tend to basically go away, you know, drop out of the school. And I wonder if he's given some thought to trying to create a school for, you know, more like a trade prep school, perhaps, than academics.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, you're making a good point. Not everybody necessarily needs to go to a four-year college. I would hasten to add that I think we write off a lot of kids too soon before we know whether they can survive and do and excel in a 4-year college. 2-year colleges, community colleges, many of them have not only very fine academic offerings, but they have courses that lead into vocational training. But it's pretty hard to drop out of high school and then go out there in the job market and get very much. So I would like to see every kid graduate from high school, ideally, and at least get a 2-year college program or a training program in a certified, bona fide job training program where every kid has kind of a next step.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks for that. Let's go to Mark in Redding. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Cummins.
Good morning. A two-part question. Approximately what does it cost per pupil in the schools you work with, and how does that compare with LA Unified?
Well, that's a great question, and I've actually written a book entitled Two Americas, Two Educations. And it sounds like you know something about this issue, because across the country, there's this huge disparity of what we spend per pupil in various public schools in certain parts of the state or the city, and what we spend in independent schools, what parochial schools spend per pupil, and what we spend to lock a kid up for a year, and it's just all over the place. To give you a couple quick examples, one block from my old school, Crossroads, is a very poor parochial school where they're spending a little over $3,000 per pupil. One block away at my old school, Crossroads, they're spending $37,000 per pupil.
Wow.
LAUSD this year is spending somewhere around $9,000 per pupil, although some charter schools have been able to raise additional funds to make that more like $10,000. And then, depending on who you talk to, in our incarceration facility, where we lock boys up for 6 months or a year, we're spending somewhere between $125,000 and $200,000 a year per bed to lock a kid up for a year.
Wow.
So our priorities on spending are really kind of mixed up, upside down in many cases, and grossly unfair.
Which brings us back, I guess, to a major point for folks listening, because, you know, we're talking to a largely public school kind of audience here, is where most people go. Can public school duplicate or at least come close to emulating what you did at Crossroads?
Well, that's a huge topic for another hour, but the answer to that, I believe, is yes, we can. But I believe it's a national issue, and it would involve really taking a close look at our priorities as a nation. Our federal spending on education compared to other industrial nations is really low. Our spending on defense, I'm afraid I'm getting political here a little bit, but is greater than all the other industrial nations of the world put together. So we have a priority on spending money on the military and industrial complex, and we give lip service to education, but we don't fund it nearly as much as I think we need to. When I bring that up, people then get nervous because then they think I'm going to be talking about raising taxes in order to have more money for education, and that certainly is one possibility because if you're going to improve your product, you frequently need to spend more on it.
Testing. We just grazed this earlier, and it's a big feature of what goes on with students in public schools and a lot of the federal bills, No Child Left Behind, which just got left behind itself.
Right.
Testing is so big now. I mean, is there too much of it? Is there not enough of it?
There's too much of it. And even Arne Duncan, toward the end of his stay, started admitting that, and the President of the United States recently made some comments about that. Every kid should be able to pass sort of minimal standardized tests. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't test kids periodically to find out how we as a school, as a nation, whatever, are doing. But to make testing the focus of what the school does so that you're constantly doing pre-testing, you're teaching kids how to take tests. You're sending teachers off to conferences and workshops so that they can learn how to prepare kids for the test. It's become a big industry. People are making a lot of money off of the testing and of teaching teachers and all of that. And it squeezes the joy out of education. At the end of the day, if kids are doing well on standardized tests, okay, fine, but that's not what people out in the world are saying they need. They say that what we're desperately in need of are creative thinkers. Well, creativity is death on a standardized test.
Yeah, just filling in the boxes doesn't quite stimulate the juices the way folks would hope. The book really does provoke a lot of thinking on the part of the reader about education, and you can find out more at the website for the Coalition for Engaged Education. The book is called Confessions of a Headmaster. Paul F. Cummins wrote it and joined us on the exchange today. Paul, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a wonderful interview.
All right, take care.